Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Climate Emergency Forum. I'm Herb Simmons. I'm author of A Climate Vocabulary of the Future, and I'll be your host today. On this channel, we spend a great deal of time dissecting the what and the how of the climate emergency, the complex physics, the shifting economics, the slow-moving gears of international policy, and the debates and the 1.5s and the 400 parts per million. But we don't often talk enough about the who. We don't often talk enough about the individuals who, in many cases, have spent their entire lives in the trenches, often long before the world even woke up to the scale of the climate emergency. And so last year, we decided to bring on some of what we call the pioneers who've made their mark on this field, our sort of giants of climate. We've had the British oceanographer Peter Wadhams and Sir David King, the founder of the Center of Climate Repair. And today I'm really pleased and excited that Janos Pastor is joining us. Janos, you're going to talk about your work, your life, and the unique perspective from all the decades working in the UN and in private NGOs and elsewhere. We understand you're coming from the wonderful shores of Lake Geneva, and what I understand is a very beautiful sunny day, so we should all cherish that. To look back on your journey is really to look back at the history of climate action itself. You were born in Hungary, you're a citizen of Switzerland, and you began your career with a deep technical foundation, earning both bachelor's and master's degrees in nuclear engineering from MIT. And that propelled you to the highest echelons of climate diplomacy, senior positions at the UN, being Assistant Secretary for Climate Change under Ban Ki-moon, a key figure at the World Wildlife Fund, at the Brundtland Commission, the group that first defines sustainable development for the world. And most recently, you led the Carnegie Climate Governance Initiative. But you're not just a figure of history. You're very much, whether you willingly or not, we don't know. We'll find out at the center of some of today's intense debates. And we'll be getting into that in a moment. We'll explore that transition. With us today is our longtime panelist, Paul Beckwith. Paul, you're a climate system scientist and host of our very popular YouTube program on the climate emergency. And as a reminder to our viewers, stay with us after this conversation for the Climate 3, where I will be presenting three of the biggest stories of the past week. Please like this program, subscribe to our channel, and visit our website at climateemergencyforum.org to donate and to leave your suggestions for future programs. Janos, welcome. We want to jump right into it there with a moment that, in some respects, may prove to change everything, how we all live and work there. I understand you were probably sitting, maybe having breakfast or lunch, overlooking that lovely lake and enjoying your well-deserved retirement when you heard from a company at that time, as I understand it, was quite secretive. They still are. No website, an Israeli-American company called Stardust, kind of Star Trek-y, if you will. And as I understand, they wanted you to work with them in some capacity to examine their efforts to develop some kind of proprietary, which is probably another word for secret, system that could literally cool the whole planet. A private company wanting to do this, you got a phone call or an email or a letter or a knock on your door. Tell us what happened. We'll have time during the program to go into the details, but give us at least a little tease of how that happened, what your thoughts were, and anything else you'd like to say to begin with on Stardust.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on this program, and I really look forward to our conversation. There is a lot going on, and there's a lot to talk about. It's true that what happened was that after we closed down the Carnegie Climate Governance Initiative, I was really looking forward to now real retirement, where I can just sort of read and write and play with my grandchildren and so on. And yes, I did get a phone call to invite me to a Zoom call with a bunch of scientists, and I knew the overall topic was going to be solar radiation modification, but I didn't know exactly what the call was going to be about. So I was a bit surprised when I am there in front of a couple of scientists, and they say that they are doing this work, as you said, Herb. They are doing research and development of the technology of stratospheric aerosol injection, and they are covering the whole works, both to develop the material, the particle, the dispersion system, and the monitoring and evaluation systems. And it's a for-profit private company, formally an American company registered in Delaware, but practically an Israeli company working in Tel Aviv. So I got this call, they asked me to join them because they felt that their work could not really continue without governance. There is no governance around these techniques or even the research part of these techniques. They felt that they needed to develop some ideas on how they can perhaps encourage governance and also how they can also govern themselves until some kind of more formal governance appears. They actually wanted me to join them, and I really had to think hard about that because I just felt very difficult for me to join a for-profit company on this topic. I don't have a problem with for-profit companies, but for-profit on the issue of stratospheric aerosol injection and knowledge has to be transparently available and so on. I had difficulty with that. I also had difficulty with working with an Israeli company. I'm be very honest there. I do a lot about peace for Palestine, and that was a challenging issue for me. But at the same time, I realized that this, from a substantive point of view, this was actually very important because Stardust is not the only actor doing this kind of work. And frankly, the way the climate situation is moving on, I suspect there will be more in the future. And the development of appropriate governance is actually quite important. And that goes beyond the fact that it's private sector, for-profit, Israel, all of these issues. So after considerable reflection, I went back and I said, okay, I'm prepared to do this under three conditions. The first condition was that whatever I write will be public. In other words, complete transparency. So in a way, I'm not going to write a report to Stardust, but I will write a report to the world at the request of Stardust. And they agreed to that. The second was that they also follow increasingly transparency, which at that time there was nothing, as you said, Herb, and so on. And then the third was that whatever remuneration I get for this work, I will give it to an NGO. That was the agreement. And we agreed and we started working. My job was not to look at the technical aspects. So I know actually very little about the technology. I know something because it was important to know the context, but my focus was definitely not what material, what dispersion system, and so on, but broadly speaking, the governance issues, both in terms of the implications of their work on everybody else, on the rest of the world, and what the rest of the world might need to do in order to respond to the governance need of such an activity.
Yeah, let me just ask you to kind of zoom out, if you will, for those of our viewers who may not be even familiar with the solar radiation management and wondering why are we even talking about this and what's it matter that there's this company called Stardust that you work with for some period of time. So could you just give us a brief kind of primer on the larger context of what they're doing and why it's so potentially important and will could literally affect every person and plant and animal alive on this planet.
Well, the context is, of course, the continuing of greenhouse gas emissions and therefore the continued increase in global temperatures. At the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change at the Paris conference, it was agreed that the world will try to limit the temperature rise to less than 2 degrees, if possible, close to 1.5. That's the agreement. And then since Paris, in fact, the political consensus has been 1.5, not even 2. But that hasn't formally changed, but that's the context. When you look at the official records of temperature, the annual temperatures have already passed the 1.5 last year and the year before. But of course, when we talk about temperature, average temperature change, we're talking about measuring it over a period of usually 20 years. So we're not quite there in terms of that average, but we're soon going to get there. And the context is that this temperature change is creating increasingly significant and often catastrophic impacts. And we've seen some of the impacts, whether it was Pakistan, a third of Pakistan underwater, major forest fires in California, droughts followed by flooding in many countries like China, and so on and so forth. These are becoming really serious, both in terms of human lives, but also very, very serious in terms of economic impacts. Then the question is, what can one do about this? Of course, the first response is, let's cut our emissions much faster than we're doing it. But the reality is that a lot of this increasing temperatures for the future is already baked in because we already have enough carbon in the atmosphere to make this happen. So yes, we must reduce the emissions and eliminate them. But in the next few decades, maybe a few generations, we're kind of pretty much baked in a substantial temperature increase that will continue to give us these significant and often catastrophic impacts. So what else can one do? Well, one can try to adapt to the higher temperatures, and many people are doing that at the city level, more air conditioning, which of course uses more energy, but better building, green building, and things like that you can do. But scientists have said, well, we can also find ways to actually cool the planet, or cool at least part of the planet in certain places. There are different ways of doing it. Globally, one refers to these technologies, techniques as solar radiation modification. There are many names for it, but I use the IPCC terminology, solar radiation modification. It includes things at the ground level, where you cover things to reflect sunlight. It includes marine cloud brightening, where you spray sea salt into clouds, make them whiter, and reflect more sunlight back into space. And most controversially, but also in terms of scale, that the most significant one is stratospheric aerosol injection, where you spray certain particles, materials like sulfur, sulfuric acid, that become aerosols up there and reflect sunlight and therefore cool the planet.
And that's essentially what Stardust was proposing, some form
Exactly.
yet to be publicly talked about. I think that really gives us an important context for the rest of our conversation. But let me right now turn it over to Paul. I know, Paul, you've got lots of questions. You've been following the same issues that Janos has been involved in for many years.
Thank you, Herb, and thanks, Janos. I guess first, what comes to mind is I think that Stardust is one of the leading companies in the solar radiation management aerosol injection field, with 25 employees, 25 plus, and 75 million funding. I think that was at least from a year or two ago, probably bigger now. But what other companies would you say are looking at it? And I think there's huge potential to draw down carbon extremely quickly. We know the ocean absorbs 25% of CO2. Most people don't realize where that carbon in the ocean is drawn down. It turns out a huge fraction of it is drawn down in eddies that push water downwards. And there is ideas to withdraw vast amounts of CO2 from the atmosphere by iron seeding in the ocean in those eddies. So that's very interesting work. But I guess my main question to you is, when we talk about what the world is doing, we exclude China because we don't know what China's doing. They seem to be a black box. I think that's a huge mistake because China is a nation that's run by engineers, and they're doing tremendous amounts of work in oceanography research and basic physics research. And because it's a nation of engineers, they could just go out without governance and start drawing down CO2 if they think it will work and scale it up. I'm most interested in what you think about China from all of your work in negotiations and stuff.
There are two or three main questions that you've posed. First, very briefly, Stardust is perhaps the most significant one in terms of as an actor that has substantial resources to do their work. There is also another startup, which is nonprofit, called Reflective. Their purpose is very similar, to develop the technology, but because they're a nonprofit, they can be much more, and they are much more transparent and share their information differently than Stardust is able to do. So those are two key ones. There's also other entities like Silver Lining, Make Sunsets, and in different ways they are doing different sort of things, but broadly speaking in this space. But what is also important is that universities in many parts of the world are actually doing some pretty interesting and pretty substantial research that sort of adds up to increasing knowledge base about these. So we can try to go through that, but there is actually quite a lot, and it's definitely increasing in terms of these activities. Now, carbon removal, you're absolutely right. First of all, the IPCC was very clear that there is no way the world can reach net zero without very substantial activities to remove carbon of the order of many gigatons per annum, and the many will be defined very much by how much mitigation we're actually able to do, how much reduction of emissions we can do. The more reduction we can do, the less carbon removal we have to do, and perhaps the less cooling we may need to do as well. But that's we know where we are on emission reductions. The story is not fantastic. But the challenge with carbon removal is that when you look at the amount of startups and actual carbon removal that is taking place since it has become clear that carbon removal is an essential part of our toolbox, it's very little. It's taking too long. And that's just part of the problem, that both the emission reductions and the carbon removal are taking so long. And in the meantime, the temperature is getting higher and higher. And that's why certain people say, well, we must really look at this cooling methods, because otherwise there will be way too many and serious impacts that we will be facing. So that's sort of the situation where we're in. In terms of China, I'm not sure if I totally agree with you that it's such a black hole, because they publish more scientific papers than the United States, some of it in English and some of it in Chinese. So we just need to learn Chinese if you want to know what's going on. They also had, even on solar radiation modification, they had a $3 million program researching the impacts at Beijing Normal University, which is now finished. But they produced quite a few interesting papers, many of them in English as well. So those are available. So it is not a complete black hole. It's challenging when they speak a different language and they write in a different language most of the time. I've been doing quite a bit of work in China in the last few years and been visiting it quite a bit. And I find that things have, we all know how incredible evolution they went through in terms of the production of renewable electricity and the use of renewable electricity through EVs and transportation systems, and you name it. So that is fairly well known. But what I've noticed myself is that, for example, on carbon removal, when 5, 6 years ago, when I was talking to the senior politicians, they said, no, we don't do that. That's not for us. And now carbon removal is everywhere. And they are working, they're different scientists and also the government itself. We had the same situation when I was there many times with the Carnegie Initiative. The senior officials didn't want to talk about SRM. Maybe that's changing now. I feel there is a little bit more understanding that one actually has to talk about this and figure out a bit more the risks, the benefits, and the governance challenges so that we can then come to some kind of a decision on that at some point. Now, just as a side issue, I was asked to write an article for the China Sustainability Review from last month when I was there. I just submitted my article last week, and I spent quite a bit of time on this question of addressing, considering at a societal level the issue of cooling the planet. And just yesterday, I got their reaction that they're fine with the article. They're now going to translate it, and it will be published. So there you go. So yeah, so I think China is not opposed to, but not yet ready to really start serious conversations about it. But things I think things are changing there on this particular issue.
I just want to say that the urgency seems to have notched up in the last several weeks, even the idea that we do need to do, I call it the three-legged bar stool. And, zeroing emissions is not good enough because we'll be stuck at our present levels of CO2, 421, and we'll still have all these disasters and catastrophes. What I'm talking about is the probability of the AMOC shutting down and other tipping points coming into play. Doesn't that set the urgency even that much higher for the necessity to deploy, look at SRM, look at carbon removal? Like, if the AMOC fails, shuts off, we're looking at north of 60 degrees north latitude dropping up to 7 degrees Celsius in temperature. Antarctica, south of 60 degrees south, raising 6 degrees. How we're not going to be able to grow food. We're not going to be able to do anything. It's going to be catastrophic. So why are the powers to be in the West ignoring this?
I share your assessment of the urgency. I think in some places, in some governments, some advisors are also sharing it. Look what happened in Iceland, where they now recognize that the AMOC issue could be a major security threat. And they even included in that report a reference to stratospheric aerosol injection being one method that can help to potentially, because we are not sure yet, but potentially to address or help that issue. So slowly it's happening, but I mean, this is a longer, for me, this has been a longer term challenge that government representatives, whether they're ministers or senior advisors, they have a real hard time to talk about these issues because they've been so focused on keeping 1.5 alive. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but because when you're so focused on this, then you can't do anything else. You're not prepared. I think this is a real problem. And very interestingly, I mean, from our experience in the C2G, when we were going to see many senior government officials in over 70 countries, we talked with senior officials. And I can tell you that the people who were involved in the UNFCCC negotiations were the least ready to talk about these issues compared to everybody else. One thing is to make this statement and describe the challenge, but one thing is how do we go beyond that? And I think for me, that's the most important thing.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up if I could on that, because I've talked to a couple of scientists who've been involved sort of off the record with solar radiation management research, and they've told me that behind the scenes, and this is sort of getting at your unparalleled previous experience and maybe current experience talking to people sort of off the record behind the scenes, that many more people were open to some form of cooling, but because of various social constraints and lack of social acceptance and peer pressure and other things, government policy, they weren't able or willing to be able to talk about it publicly. And just like in the United States, surveys show that so many people support climate action, but when you ask in surveys whether other people support it, they say no. They feel they're alone because it's not talked about publicly. And I'm wondering whether you have found that to be true. And it seems to me what I've always thought is what's needed, and I've yet to really see it except from a couple science open letters, is a group of people with prestige and experience and high international profiles basically sort of coming out together with a press conference, an open letter, some mechanism to basically say, we need to take this third leg seriously, and whatever the specific language is, whether it's more research or governance or some combination. And I'm just wondering whether what I'm saying resonates with your experience.
It resonates, but partially. So, in the experience that we gained during the C2G years, and also in my conversations since then, frankly, I don't think there are so many people who are ready to say now that we should cool the planet. There are some, but not that many. But there are many, and increasingly so, who are prepared to consider this seriously and figure out what additional information does one need in order to be able to make evidence-based decisions on whether or not to deploy, and if it's yes, then what kind of governance structure does one need to develop that can then ensure proper cooling of the planet for X period of time. And if it's no, then deal with the implications, because that's also pretty important, right? So I think there is increasing number of people in government positions and elsewhere who are prepared to have that conversation and who are prepared to see where this is going to go.
And are they willing to come out publicly? I guess is my point, because
Very
as
few,
long as
very
it's
few,
private,
very few.
yeah.
But that's, for me, is the big thing that one needs to crack that problem. And one way, I think, is to try to find champions, people who are well known, who have been recognized for one thing or the other. They don't have to be necessarily climate scientists. They
Exactly.
can be, but the idea is to have people who understand society, who understand politics, and yes, who understand something about the climate challenges the world is facing, who can then be able to talk about this and say that, okay, it's okay. We can have normal conversations about this issue, and let's have those conversations. And to me, if we can succeed in doing that and generate societal conversations within countries and between countries and science policy dialogues, again, it has to be eventually international.
Yeah, the challenge is having those people come forward. I mean, I just did, a tiny little piece myself at the Baku COP when I was invited to a reception with Al Gore, and I asked him what he thought. And I sort of knew what he thought before I asked him, but he gave me what I would call the Al Gore kind of a scowl, and in the deepest voice that I won't try to mimic there, basically said, "Moral hazard." In other words, he was so antagonistic towards even bringing up the idea of cooling the planet that it was, again, I was aware of that in, sort of in advance. I hope that whether you're able to say it publicly today or not, but I hope you at least privately know with some people that you can, we can, others can come out publicly, hopefully together, as in so many other issues, to begin to create the social acceptance.
Yeah, I mean, I if I had a list of people who are prepared to do this, then they would already be doing it, I can guarantee you. So that's part of the problem. But I think there are changes. And you mentioned Al Gore. Al Gore was totally negative also about carbon removal. He's no longer that. He doesn't mention anymore that there's moral hazard and whatever comes with carbon removal. So things evolve. Recently, I've heard Christiana Figueres say things about near-term climate risks and what we can do about it and what we're actually doing about it. I could not have imagined her saying this 6 to 12 months ago. So things are evolving. Maybe the thing to do, those who are still engaged in one or the other institution, is to try to see who are these people and how far are they prepared to go, and have more conversations and more events and things like that. And maybe one day it's going to click, and then it's going to go very fast. Because let's face it, even on carbon removal, I mean, we all knew since the previous IPCC report that this was a given, that one had to do carbon removal. But the moment when this became clear was when Angela Merkel said in Germany, net zero. And we're going to need to get to net zero. And suddenly everybody was talking about carbon removal, even in Germany, where it was an almost taboo subject.
Well, I mean, that's really is such an important point. Again, it gets back to getting one or more leaders, whether it's in the civic arena, the political arena, universities, to essentially say the emperor has no clothes. We have no choice but to see if we can do this feasibly. As Paul said, it's urgent. We've got the AMOC, we've got the Amazon, we've got so many potentially irreversible actions that are occurring, and it would be the biggest tragedy in human history if we were like a decade or two too late, because people weren't willing to do it now rather than a decade from now.
Yeah, I think the
Well,
moral hazard of not doing SRM and carbon removal, I would say, is much, much higher now than any moral hazard of trying it and scaling it up. And also, when people talk about net zero again, how come nobody talks about removing more carbon than net zero, canceling out our emissions by removal, and then bringing our CO2 levels back down to what we know is safe? right? I mean, the net zero people, they never talk about that. Imagine we could do net zero in, say, 2 decades. The CO2 levels will be 500 parts per million or 480 or whatever, which is catastrophic for society, right? We're seeing these catastrophes today, and imagine what they'll be like, in, say, 15, 20 years if we reach net zero. So net zero, we got to move beyond the idea of net zero. And there's only one way I see that is scalable to allow us to go beyond net zero, and that's increasing the amount that the oceans sequester with carbon. And that's the cheapest by far. So I recommend Climate Restoration Alliance. Have a look at this group and their ideas on getting beyond net zero.
I,
Okay,
I'm
let's.
actually on a on an advisory group of a small NGO called Oceanary that is precisely focused on that. So I tend to agree with you, but the problem we're facing is that a lot of work has to be done and to achieve some kind of social license for moving forward, because these technologies have a bad name. There are some historical reasons for that, and it's doubly hard to actually make the move that one needs to do. I also want to mention, Herb, it's just that there is another a big obstacle, I think, is that we talk too easily and maybe too much about the technology, SRM, CDR, same thing, instead of focusing and framing the issue in the problems we are trying to solve. The problem is the global heating. That's the problem and the impacts that is causing. And if you start with that, then you end up with some options, including more adaptation, different kinds of adaptation, building resilience, and also cooling. So that it's different than if you just say, well, how are we going to do SRM? You know, that's too quickly focused on the technology, and I think people have a hard time with that.
Let's turn to your career. I mean, you spent some decades at some of the highest levels of the United Nations and its associated organizations. I think most of us, I think it's fair to say, have only a vague sense of what organizations like that are. What are they, what they do, how do they operate? Can you just sort of give us some insights, some broad insights, maybe an anecdote or two about what your career was there and what stood out for you? Maybe what surprised you?
So I was always interested in physics, in science, mathematics. I had a fantastic teacher in my high school in Nairobi, where I went to high school. I really loved physics, and I was going to do nuclear physics, nuclear engineering. That's what I wanted to do. And I ended up in certainly probably one of the best universities in the world to study that. And then something happened. I read a book. I read a book called The Limits to Growth. And I said, wow, this is what I want to do. This is interesting. And then I read more. I actually wanted to quit university. I didn't, thanks to my thesis advisor. And that's sort of where I ended up. And interestingly, I think you mentioned in the introduction that the Brundtland Commission, where I did work in the early 80s, mid-80s, was the one who defined sustainable development. Well, actually, that's not quite true. There were quite a few others before it, but it was the Brundtland Commission that really took it to the political reality, because they had a mandate from the UN General Assembly for that commission. And that makes it important, because that means that you report back to the General Assembly of the UN when the report is done. And that's quite important. What happened then is I started working in various international organizations, NGOs, and then later in the Brundtland Commission, and then eventually UNEP was my first real UN job. I think what's important in this is that when I was back then, I knew broadly what I wanted to work on. I liked this idea. I liked the global issues that arose. So it was kind of clear that I wanted to work in international organizations of different kinds, but I didn't have a clear strategy that I'm going to work here, that I'm going to work there. Many young people, when I talk to them, they want to be very clear which organization and so on. I had no such plan. I just had a broad idea. But now, when I look back after 50 years in the business, there is a very nice path there. You know, it happened. So there is a path, but it was not something that I meticulously planned in advance. And I think that's That's something important. I must say, I've been unbelievably lucky during these 5 decades, where starting with my parents and then my physics teacher in Nairobi, and then my first and second and third and other bosses, they always let me do things instead of constraining me, instead of telling me what to do. They gave me wings and opened it up and said, go and do it, find out, you know. And I think altogether, that's what really made me where what I ended up. So that helped me to win physics prizes in my high school and work in the office of the UN Secretary General and engage in bilateral conversations with heads of states and government about climate change and related issues, and a lot of stuff in between as well. I feel I didn't waste my time in the last 4 or 5 decades, but I also feel that the job is undone, and I feel very bad about that because I have children, I have grandchildren. I fear that the remainder of the century is going to be very challenging. In theory, my grandchildren will live through exactly that period, and I'm worried, I must say. It is possible to see the results of these things. Not always obvious, but take, for example, one sort of big thing, the Kyoto Protocol. So I was part of the secretariat and I engaged a lot on this issue. We collectively, the governments, with the support of the secretariat, we produced a treaty, the Kyoto Protocol, which was pretty damn good. I know that in the United States, the Kyoto Protocol is not looked at very positively, but I'm sorry. The Kyoto Protocol was fantastic and it delivered things that we're still making use of that. And I was part of that. And so I think that as a direct outcome of hard work is there. But also looking at it even at a very personal level. So, for example, in the 2010s, I was executive secretary of a high-level panel of the UN Secretary General on Global Sustainability. This was a panel of ministers, prime ministers, and the two chairs were President Halonen of Finland and President Zuma of South Africa. And President Zuma was not engaging. And it was really a problem because we needed the two co-chairs. And I was telling his Sherpa that I need to speak bilaterally, privately with President Zuma to say that he has to engage. And it didn't happen. And finally, I get a call. I'm in New York at that time. I get a call from Pretoria that on Friday at 5:30 in his home, in his residence, you have 30 minutes. So, I get in the plane 16 hours, and go to Pretoria. I prepared like you won't believe it. I made my briefing in 15 minutes. Then he had some questions, so on. And then suddenly our conversation started. And believe it or not, the meeting lasted 1.5 hours, not 30 minutes. He told me his story, his time in prison, and his engagement in the liberation, South Africa. All of that was incredible. I went back to New York, and guess what? After that, he was engaged. And, it was successful. So, again, it's the kind of concrete output. So, one can measure these things and one can remember them. And when it's good, then you feel proud. And sometimes when it doesn't work so well, then you learn from it and do something else.
So if you were to sort of generalize, if you can, since you've had interactions with so many world leaders and the Sherpas of world leaders and the assistant secretaries of this and that and whatever in countries all over, I think so many people are interested. What are these people like in private? Are they saying the same thing as they are in public? Are there any generalities? Are they just people or what?
I think it's fair to say that senior people in government have their official position and they have their personal position, and they are often different. And that's because they can be convinced about the need for something, some issue, but they know that there are political and other constraints so that they are unable to actually go out and talk about that. And I'd be very concrete. When we started working on with the Carnegie Climate Governance Initiative, and we started going to see senior government officials, many of whom I engaged with when I was Assistant Secretary General in the United Nations. So it was, especially at the beginning, people I knew. The typical reaction was, yeah, Janos, this is really important. This is so, this you guys are doing the right thing. But don't ever talk about this outside this room, or rather that they cannot talk about this outside this room, for the reasons in part what we already discussed. And so you have this, it's not like necessarily that people are, they want to lie or something, but there are constraints on leaders, and it's a reality, and one has to find ways to help them. I think this is something I've learned from my work in international processes, whether NGO or intergovernmental, is that sometimes countries need other countries to help them to say something that on their own they couldn't say alone in their countries. But if they say that there are 20 other countries that are
Well,
behind
exactly.
this, it's easier. Especially if it's something that costs money or that is challenging, where they have to change policy or something like that. So the idea of international cooperation and engagement is like, Münchhausen, who pulls himself out of the mud. Here, the people together can pull themselves out, and the countries together can pull themselves out and then able to say. So it's very interesting what's happening right now in Colombia with the countries that were invited by the Netherlands and Colombia, who are more ambitious in terms of their shift away from fossil fuels. We'll see where that goes. But it's again, it's collectively those countries can do more than if each of those countries went to their homes and said, okay, well, we're going to have to do this, we're going to have to do that.
Paul, your
Yeah.
thoughts?
Yeah, I'm very interested in the influence that the book by the Club of Rome, Limits to Growth, had. I think that was published in 72. When a book was published back then, right, the publishing industry was completely different. People just read. They didn't have options in digital and devices. So it's hard to imagine a book today influencing a person as much as, say, that book influenced you. Books back then could have tremendous influence, and today we're in a different world. We're pulled in every direction. I don't think this is a good thing where nobody's on the same page anymore, to give a book metaphor. Everybody's on a different page. Even academics, they've all read different papers, different stuff, because of the proliferation of information and data and papers, even in the science community. It used to be you'd go to a science conference and everybody's has the basic sort of background and understanding to work as a grounding, and then develop stuff is developed from them. But now you go, everybody's coming on a different page, coming with different information. So it's much more difficult to get things done, especially with AI and misinformation and stuff. It makes it very difficult to solve problems today.
I agree with you in part, but I think also the technologies that we have are, on the one hand, do what you describe, but on the other hand, they also help us to solve the issues, to communicate those issues. Before, at the very beginning of my career, if you published a book, then you published it, and then it went into the bookstores, and some people bought it and read it, and that was just about it. And some people then organized seminars in universities or town halls and things like that. But now there is a lot more options that we have available, and it's harder, maybe it's harder, but it is ultimately, if you know how to use how to make use of these different methods. I think it's remarkable how you can actually reach people. I don't have huge followers on LinkedIn or Facebook or anything like that. I stopped my X account for other reasons some time ago. But I do read books and I publish my reviews on it. I get reactions, tens of people, not thousands or 10,000s, but it's there. So these are things that we can use. And I think that we, the old generation, I hate to say this about myself, but I am part of the old generation. Now, there's no way around it. But if we want to continue to engage in today's world, we have to understand the mechanisms that work in today's world and make use of them. For example, one of the books I reviewed, and there was quite a few feedback on LinkedIn and Facebook, and that was nice. And then somebody, a friend of mine, wrote back and said, maybe you should start doing this on TikTok, brief reviews. And I'm thinking about it. I haven't started that. I'm not sure how that would work, but I'm at least thinking about it because that is the way when I go in the subway and the young people are just there with their phones and they're going one after the other, you know. They want short pieces. There are things you can do in short pieces as well.
Speaking of how to use something best, you know, if you had to give yourself advice from today's Janos to the starting out Janos, what might you say?
I think what I did is actually what I should have done, knowing what is the world today. Because those things, I mean, the limits to growth, small is beautiful, the path not taken, you know, all these books, they were ahead of their times, right? And I absorbed those and I said, wow, this is the sort of area where I want to be. I think it just was right on track. And then, of course, if I had known where we are today, maybe I would have pushed harder in some areas, but I don't think I would have done it differently because it's the places where I worked are precisely the places which have and which need to advance the discussions and implementation about these issues.
Could you tell us about the opportunity that might have that almost happened? I think you said it was in 2020 by Belgium taking the lead in trying to convene a, you know, world effort or United Nations effort to talk with other countries about cooling the planet, just at the arrival of COVID. And what was that all about? And the serendipity of COVID, I think it's quite a story.
It is quite a story, and things, you know, when you remember back, you say, what would have happened had that actually taken place? So to go back in time, 2019, end of 2019, the Belgian government was preparing to be the president of the Security Council early in 2020. As all countries, when they become presidents of the Security Council, which of course is rotating, right? They all want to do something special. They wanted to do something on SRM, solar radiation modification. I had been to Brussels before, so they knew about C2G. So they asked us for views and advice, and we ended up having a very interesting conversation. They wanted to do it in the Security Council, and we actually advised them not to do it because we felt that it wouldn't go very far given the state of the Security Council. But instead, we suggested something that people often refer to as the Ariel method, is just to have an open public debate in the General Assembly about these issues. And they accepted that. So we developed an agenda, we got speakers, we had the chair of the event, everything was ready literally the day before the invitations went out from the Belgian mission to the United Nations. New York shut down because of the COVID. And that was it. And by the time it was back in operation, Belgium was no longer the president of the Security Council. And, you know, it was a missed opportunity, a completely missed opportunity. And had there been at that time the kind of conversation about the risks, benefits, governance challenges of this solar radiation modification in the General Assembly with all the countries there and asking questions, maybe the whole situation would have ended up quite a bit different than what was the case. But it was a
Wow.
missed opportunity, and there you go.
The governance of SRM, for example, I think, you know, is going to involve many countries and many discussions, and it's going to take time. Meanwhile, any billionaire on this planet could just go and start deploying SRM. And I guess if they do it correctly and it works, starts bringing down temperatures, then great, they become a hero in the world. But if they screw it up, you know, do something wrong, then the public could go against the idea of SRM forevermore, and then we'll be faced with these tipping points like the AMOC and so on. Does this worry you? I mean, when I say any billionaire could do it, I mentioned earlier China could just say in a 5-year plan, we're going to draw down CO2, we're going to do this, and there's no governance there, or limited government. It's not governed by the West, shall we say. They can just go and do it as engineers, and that's what engineers basically do, right? So I don't know. I mean, have you thought much about these sort of things?
Not just me personally, but C2G, but also the IPCC itself has written about this. So, but I think one needs to distinguish between unilateral action by a country, by a state, as opposed to action by a non-state actor, such as a billionaire. Frankly, I really don't think that at this point in time, this might change in the future, but at this point in time, I don't see how a billionaire can actually do this without clear support from one major country. Because it's not just having the billions, it's having all the planes, having the locations in different parts of the world from where the planes will go up and spray the whatever material. So if a billionaire says, I'm going to do it, and if the countries or some countries don't like it, they just shoot the hell out of the planes. It won't happen, right? So, or there is actually an agreement, or secret or otherwise, between a country and a non-state actor that they will help, make it happen. That's a very different story. But I think it remains that ungoverned unilateral action, whether it's by state or non-state, is a real problem. You don't even have to do something wrong for people to believe that you have screwed up the weather. And that's the problem. The
That's the
perception
problem. Yeah.
is more important than the actual thing. So, you can start, let's say, a stratospheric air assault project, and the following year the monsoons are late or something in India, and
You're
whether you
blamed.
can attribute it to SAI or not, the perception of the people who are missing their rain, it's going to be that you have done it. And God knows what impact that will have on geopolitical relations.
I mean, there's so many daunting issues, as you know, because you've studied them and Carnegie did for years. But to me, that seems almost the most insoluble one of how do you, particularly in an age, and you talk about this all the time, Paul, of disinformation and misinformation, that there's so many people that think geoengineering is going on now. We've got 30 states in the United States that have bills to ban it. Two or three states have already banned it, and it's not even happening. Much less when it's the first test. Have you come across any kind of plausible response other than massive amounts of public information?
It's not just public information, it's development of social license to engage, and it cannot be simply at the national level. It has to be somehow at the international level. Now, that is not easy. It's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of effort. But unless we have that, you cannot have a reasonable way to go forward on this issue, because there will always be people, countries, regions who will say, come on, it's all your fault. But even if there are problems, if there is really a kind of an internationally agreed procedure to move forward, because we're in a really difficult situation in terms of climate impacts, then at least there is a way to explain to those who will be worse off. Because we know that stratospheric aerosol injection will likely improve the global temperatures for most people, but there will be some, and whether it's 5% or 10% who will be worse off, they will be worse off, and one has to deal with it. And 5%, 10% of 10 billion people, it's a lot of people.
Janos, you were director of an organization for a few years at Carnegie that was focused on governance. But I think, as I understand it, you have a very broad perspective of what governance is and isn't, and is part of this whole sort of landscape. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. I think there are sort of two levels. One is that governance is not simply action by governments to regulate, but something much broader where the whole of society is involved in working towards or against some change in the society. Some call that a social license, working on a social license for it or against it. And that involves not just governments, but also local governments, cities, academia, private sector, NGOs, all of that. So that's the first issue, is that governance is much broader than simply governments regulating. The second is that the governance, there are different elements that one has to look at. Right now, the most urgent is to have governance for research, because research is taking place without governance. And so one needs to have governance that addresses the research, both in terms of encouraging more research to find out more, to have more information so that one can take evidence-based decisions at some point, but also guardrails to make sure that the research takes place in conditions that make sure that society is safe, not just in terms of physical, but even psychological
Yes.
components, because people are afraid. If they're afraid, then you have to do something to make sure that they are not afraid. So now, this governance of research can happen top down, but it can also evolve bottom up. And what we're seeing today is that it's actually coming bottom up. Stardust, for example, has developed a voluntary code of conduct, which they haven't published yet, and I've been pushing them that they should, but they have. And others are doing similar. The group DSG in Washington has developed the concept also for this. So things are beginning to evolve from the bottom up, and maybe one day that will trigger governments to act. But that's one, that's for the research. But then an even more important part of governance is that at some point, society has to say clearly, yes, we want to deploy, or no, we don't want to deploy. And we need to prepare for that kind of governance process to arrive at some evidence-based decision at some point, not too long in the future, because as we said, there is urgency here. And that needs to be prepared. What kind of information does one need? In which institution, global institution, does one have that conversation and eventually those decisions? Is there one where we can do it, or do we have to create a new
Right.
process for that? So that is super important to get to an actual decision at the global level that yes, we need to do it, or no, we cannot do it for reason X, Y, and Z. And then, depending on the decision of yes or no, one has to have very substantial governance discussions of if it's yes, how are we going to do it? Who is going to turn the global thermostat up or down? Who is going to develop the aircraft, et cetera, et cetera? If not, then what else can society do? What are the, is there, are there options still other than cooling the planet and et cetera, et cetera? So these are the main elements of governance. Research governance, then governance to get to a decision, yes or no for deployment, and then governance to follow up the impact of that decision, and what are the implications?
Well, you have just laid out a very ambitious and necessary agenda that faces the world. And either the world will decide to do what you're suggesting and others, or else we're going to muddle through this with potentially disastrous consequences. But I wanted to just focus on one of the points you made because it's something that I've been concerned. I'm eager to hear your response to what I'm about to say, because what I've noticed is that there are dozens, in fact, maybe hundreds, thousands, maybe of papers all the time. I see every day there's a paper about if you do stratospheric aerosol injection at 30 degrees latitude over this country, this will result, on and on and on. And that's great and it's necessary, and somebody's going to have to put all that together. But I never see any research or conferences or workshops that talk about what I would call, and you've just referred to it, at what point might we have to actually use this? What I always hear is people who say, and I went to a panel at Washington Climate Week last week, and everybody said this, if we ever need it, we need to do the research. And my question is, well, when are we going to start talking about what are the criteria to decide when we need it or not, assuming it's safe and effective and could be shown that way? Am I correct that the world community, particularly the research community, the advocacy community, has not focused on that? When I ask this question at conferences, people sort of agree that, yeah, we really haven't started exploring that. And maybe out of fear of not wanting to sound like we're trying to support deployment or whatever.
There's no easy answer to this or easy way forward. But one problem is that it is still difficult to have a normalized conversation about these issues between the various stakeholders. It is much better than it was 5 years ago and 10 years ago. I think we are moving in the right direction on this, and it is more and more possible. And you see that in the media also, that more and more possible to actually have serious conversations about these issues. But we're not there where we need to be. And I really think that this issue is less of a, I mean, it needs scientific input, but it is more of a societal question. That on the one hand, we know that warming is creating these kinds of impacts. We have fairly good information, and we have reasonable information on how this is going to evolve in the next 10, 20, 30, 50 years, the remainder of this century. And it's not good, right? We know that. And then if you think of cooling as one of the solutions that you apply to it, then you have two options. I mean, you're more than two, but simplistically, you develop the technology as soon as possible and deploy it to avoid all those or some of those significant climate impacts. The other one is to wait until you really see how bad these impacts are, let thousands of people die, let a few island countries disappear, and then at the end you come to the, oh my God, we really have to do something now. And we have to do it quickly. So let's go for it. This is a societal conversation that we need to have. It's not inherently a scientific issue. It's more than that, but it needs scientific input because we need to know the implications of going now or going in 20 years or 30 years, etc., etc. So I think this requires the kind of conversations that we haven't had. It's beginning, though. It's beginning. For example, Pakistan had two conversations like that at the country level, and that's great. And maybe there will be more in that country and elsewhere. And I'm convinced that it's going to happen. It's not happening fast enough, like most things in the world, except picking up new technologies like ChatGPT 5 or 6 or 7, or whatever it may
Yeah,
be.
that seems to happen.
Now, the other thing I wanted to mention, and Herb, you did touch on it, a conspiracy that geoengineering is happening now. Have you been exposed to this, and what's your view on it?
First of all, when we were running the C2G initiative, we got a lot of people on X, for example, on Twitter, and sometimes they even came to some meetings we organized and disturbed the meeting. But we tried to deal with it as everything else. People have their views, and then it sort of died out. And frankly, during the last couple of years, nothing. And then came what you refer to is the various states in the United States banning geoengineering, but what they call geoengineering is not quite, I think there are some very good articles written by good people that if you haven't seen them, then it's good to see. Like Holly Jean Buck has a very, very good review of what's happening and why. So there are some interesting materials that are there. But I mean, this is not the only problem, but we identified fairly early with the Carnegie Project because we were initially called the Carnegie Climate Geoengineering Governance Initiative, C2G2. That's where we were. And after a few years, we realized that the word geoengineering was just toxic, confusing, and everybody has a different definition. And for everybody, there is a different what is included and what is excluded. So we decided to stop using it. We took it out of our name. And we decided that we will no longer use the word geoengineering, but instead refer specifically to whether it's carbon removal or solar radiation modification. Try to follow the IPCC terminology. It's not perfect, but at least there is agreement by all the member states. And the IPCC stopped using geoengineering as well. They don't use that. It's not even in their latest glossary. It used to be in their glossary, but now no longer. And I think that's part of the confusion is because it's not clear what it is, it ends up getting confused with conspiracy theorists and the wonderful. I see a lot of those trails in the sky here because Geneva is not just the people who actually land, but some of the east-west north-south routes go right above here. So I see lots of lines. Anyway,
Yeah,
but
no,
it's
it's quite a thing. I mean, they're saying that aviation's impact on the climate has more to do with these condensation trails than the actual CO2 emissions that they're generating.
It is important.
Yeah,
I don't think
yes.
it's more. I cannot see that. I'm frankly, but I do. I've read quite a few articles about the importance of these trails that can be actually avoided using relatively simple directions to the pilots of where they
Oh.
should fly.
I just saw a study where they used AI for exactly that purpose. They were able to save fuel and reduce the climate trail by using AI in a controlled experiment with a number of one or more airlines. So as we wrap up, Janos, we started this fascinating program talking about this Stardust company that has plans to cool the planet. And we just sort of did a teaser on that. But tell us a bit about what your role was there, what happened, and where things are right now.
Well, first, just a slight correction. They are not planning to cool the planet. They are planning to prepare the technology for governments to cool the planet. So, but look, my job was, as we agreed with them, as an independent consultant to work with them to look at the governance implications of what they're doing and write a report about that. And I did a report on that, and I published it on my LinkedIn page, and it had a certain set of reviews by people. Most of the feedback I got was positive. One or two were negative, and I think most of the negative related to the fact that how can you do something with an Israeli company where this is all part of the Israeli military complex and all that. And again, that's a view, and I'm not going to debate that whether they're right or wrong. But the fact is that I did not consider my mandate to look into that, but rather more specifically on what they're doing as a company. Now, since I did my report, at that time they had, I think, $16-20 million worth of investment. Now they got another $60 million, and that makes it $75 or $80 million. So they have grown. They must have been able to convince some serious people that they're doing something useful, at least for those investors. And I am not engaged with them anymore. So what I know about them is what I see in the media and so on. And they have become a little bit more transparent, not enough in my view, but still. They have. I saw their CEO, Yanai Yebdat. He was on one of their podcasts, So things are moving. My expectation from back then is that they will develop these technologies and they will get IP. Then somebody may decide to buy the technology or not. Okay. I mean, that's where it gets interesting. And even in my report, there were some indications there, which they overall endorse, that it's not simply they develop the technology and then it can be sold, but it could be provided free to governments. There could be many, many different ways of dealing with the IP. Just like Volvo, when they developed the three-point seat belt back in the 60s, they decided this was so important to save lives that they gave it away free to the world. And we all still have the basic technology for those seat belts, but Volvo developed back then, because they gave it away free. So there are many options for Stardust and the investors of Stardust to do things with the technology once it's developed. But again, just to go back to this, Stardust was very clear that they are there to develop the technology, to research and develop and do testing as necessary, but that eventually governments have to take a decision on whether or not to deploy and how.
This is something we're all in. That's why we have the Climate Emergency Forum. We need to look at every possible way to try to preserve a livable world. And you've done that for many, many decades. Our hats are off to you, Janos. And now we will turn, as we always do every week, to what we call the Climate Three. Three of the biggest climate stories that have made the headlines this past week. And first is that climate warming, of course, is intensifying heat waves all across Europe. And the question is, how does climate and climate heat affect one particular species that is probably not our favorite, which is mosquitoes? And that is that a recent study that just came out a couple of days ago showed that one of the most common species of mosquitoes may actually find that it's too hot to continue to reproduce and live in the climate that we expect, that we hope we don't have it, later this century. And so the other two species of mosquitoes that are also common in Europe, it's not clear whether they will be able to survive. Of course, the big question, or one of the big questions, is will mosquitoes adapt to this hotter climate? Will we have a different kind of mosquito than we have today? And the other question, maybe a more depressing one, is will humans be able to adapt? But we're in a sort of a race with mosquitoes. Maybe we'll adapt and they won't. That would probably be the best thing. Probably the absolute best thing would be no climate change occurring, but we don't think that's likely. Anyway, that's our first story. The second story really surprised me, and it may surprise you, and that is in the United States, clean energy installations are on track to hit another record this year and account for the vast majority of new power additions, despite the sort of rabid opposition from the Trump administration to anything with the word clean in it. You know, that the U.S. power sector is expected to add 60 gigawatts of solar battery storage and wind capacity in 2026, an increase from 50 gigawatts last year. And that is 93% of all the electricity capacity added. So essentially, almost all the additional capacity will be coming from clean sources. And if you wonder what 60 gigabytes means, or gigawatts rather, it means like 10 million homes will be able to be powered just with the additional clean energy coming on this year. The entire population of Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, based upon just 1 year. So despite the efforts in Washington to stop clean energy, it seems to have taken off to the point where it's going to continue. And that, to me, is great news. And our third story is that the Santa Marta conference in Colombia, which is starting a couple of days ago, there was a letter, an open letter, signed by over 200 legal scholars, basically reminding all of those 50 or 60 countries that there are legally binding obligations under multiple sources of international law to phase out fossil fuels, based upon the International Court of Justice opinion. And we had Dan Galperin on our program. We hope you will take a look at that program, who talked about that and was very involved in creating this statement that was sent from, again, over 250 scholars. And let me just read a sentence or two. The legal duty to phase out fossil fuels stems from multiple sources of international law, both treaties and customs, from the climate change, from Kyoto Protocol that we spoke about earlier, from the Paris Agreement, but also from customary international law, human rights law, international environment law, and the law of the sea. And I think we tend to forget, when we talk about the politics and the economics, that this is legally required. And of course, we ask you as our viewers to contact those governments, particularly if you live in one of those 60 countries, and tell them to do their job, phase out fossil fuels. That is the Climate 3 for this week. As always, we look forward to seeing you next week, where we will be talking about the Santa Marta Conference. Thanks again.